be very happy. Actually, no, because I know exactly that the clothes that you're doing have nothing to do. Like, there was no Muslim woman in the real building of that product. And also, your product is actually made on the back of other Muslim women, probably, you know. Mm-hmm. So the decorative diversity is actually really... It's very difficult also to go against it in a way, because you're just like, but you need to promote all of these diverse people. You need to promote like the LGBTQ plus community having to do campaigns for whatever brand. And I'm just like, you just want to be a money making machine for other people, because at the end of the day, it's the same shit. It's exactly the same thing. And having people really understand that the core of the problem is capitalism and white supremacy, and everything that is made in Switzerland is actually in the service of that, including all of the anti-racist law, etc. They will never do a law if it is not, again, if it is not for their own goods. And when I say own goods, I'm talking about the 2/3 of the people that are lobbying in the parliament. Mm-hmm. It's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. So we should just take the streets forever.
Hey, that's hey. Kind of
interesting suggestion.
Yeah, yeah. I heard in all of your contributions now the word interest several times, and I think that's again what becomes visible. Certain political interests, certain economic interests, geopolitical interests are defended, and they still perpetuate again that they always perpetuate, not still, they've always perpetuated the imbalance of power between what you, Tariq, call the imperial core, so between the global north and the global south. So all these practices we are talking about are finding ways of continuing those relationships. And Sasan, you were already hinting at something that would be my next question, a bit more specific than to the work you're doing, all of you differently, which is the issue of consciousness raising and awareness campaigns and the awareness work you have to do that is always also resisting certain dominant discussions and ideas about Western civilization or democracy or free market economy or even freedom or peace, as you mentioned. So all these words are used very frequently to talk about the superiority, let's put it this way, also of the global north. And I was wondering, like, if we go now more specifically into some of these ideological struggles, I would say, or how things get defined and who gets to define them. And I thought I would throw a specific question to each one of you about the work that your organizations, your groups are doing. And I would start with maybe Tariq, because currently you've already hinted at that. We all know it. We have this immense discussion about what constitutes anti-Semitism. It's one of these words that's now being used to create all kinds of divisions. And maybe... many of you have become aware that in the past few days there's been quite a lot of discussion about this new statement that is being prepared by the parties in power, CDU, SPD, Die Grünen and FDP, that claim to want to defend what they consider Jewish lives against what they call anti-Semitism. And many critics, including Jewish activists, writers and scholars living in Germany, are pointing out that this law is actually targeting, and I quote from the protest letter that Jewish intellectuals and artists wrote, they say this law is targeting leftist politics and those who come from outside of Germany. So again, uncovering the interests, right? And anyone who criticizes the state of Israel. So I was wondering for you specifically, Tariq, and for Global South United, what does it mean to do the work of awareness campaigning at this particular moment in Germany? What challenges do you face?
Mm-hmm. So I would also bring this back to the term of interest. And I imagine most of you would be familiar with the term Staatsraison, something very big in Germany right now. Staatsraison like would literally be translated as reason of the state, but it doesn't quite mean that. It's loosely translated to national interest or I would translate it even as maybe the purpose of the state. And this is usually the red card that white people in Germany always put out whenever the argument for, you know, maybe let's not participate in the mass murder of an entire population. No, but sorry, this is our Staatsraison. We have to kill them for now. And it's very funny also how this is becoming a monopoly over the discourse of what constitutes anti-Semitism. Imagine how ridiculous it would be if a white person would explain to you what racism is and tries to convince you that you are racist. And by you, I mean a non-white person. And of course, there's a lot of theories about this monopoly over the discourse. Some social scientists would argue that, you know, this is the transaction, like an actual financial transaction that Germany pays off Israel, and then Israel allows Germany to utilize or instrumentalize this discourse to whitewash the guilt and all the Vergangenheitsbewältigung and all this shit. But then there is a very simple, yet for some reason very elusive concept to the German state and to other colonial structures, which is hierarchies and power structures. And okay, before I say this, like there's a lot of light in my eyes, so I can't quite see everyone in the room, and I would like to know the proportions of white people in the room. Can we get a quick show of hands? Oh, okay. Well, so I hope you will excuse then some carefully articulated words and semantic acrobats in what I'm going to say now, but I hope you will get the gist of it. I, as a brown Arab person from a Muslim country, as it goes now, I believe that even if I wanted to, I cannot be anti-Semitic by the definition that, you know, people would understand anti-Semitism as a form of racism. And the reason why I would say something like this is that there is no narrative, there is no scenario where someone like me would think that a Jewish person is inferior to me. Of course, I'm not going to get into the whole debate that we are also Semites, blah, blah, blah. No, this is, let's not talk about this. But in the larger scheme of things now, who are, again, the subalterns? And yeah, fuck it. Like, what I wanted to say is that basically Muslims are the new Jews. And what Germany does is very interesting. There is this thing about coping with the past, as they call it, and this whole culture of remembrance. There is something that social scientists also call the migrant double bind. And it goes very well into the discourse of national identity, the German national identity. And that is, the remembrance of the Holocaust is an integral part of the German national identity. And the double bind comes here, that for you to be really integrated, to be really German, you have to remember this. You have to absorb it. It has to be a part of who you are. But at the same time, if you're an immigrant, if you're not a white person, you're not supposed to remember. It's not just a monopoly over the discourse or who is anti-Semitic and who is not. It's also a monopoly over the memory. And you can really see this when the discussion comes to that point, that people are very easily silenced by the very ironic fact that we did the biggest genocide, we know better. How fucked up is that? Thanks. Yeah, so I guess I hope this answers the question.
I think it definitely points to also what my question was, which is, again, how the power of that, you called it a monopoly over definition also. It is one of the ways in which colonial domination continues, because it was always about defining, and it was always about who gets to define what is happening and who gets to define who belongs where in the hierarchy. So it is, in a way, another example of a continuation of that. Yes,
I just wanted to add in terms of, because it's extremely interesting what you said about the monopoly of the memory. It's actually, I don't know if any of you knows France Fanon, who is an anti-colonial author. And he wrote basically that genocide in the Holocaust was actually colonization coming back home. Mm. Because everything they did in Germany against the Jews and the Roms and all of the other has been done a few years prior in Namibia, but nobody talks about that. So there's like this memory of when we did it at home, it was horrific, but when we did it in Africa and Namibia or in any other place in the world, we don't even think about it. And we can also see in terms of the position of Germany when it comes to even acknowledging their part into the Namibian genocide. They don't say it, but it was like the precursor or even the testing ground for the Holocaust. And I think that's actually really important to actually remember that what's happening, what is also going to happen, and when you said Muslims are the new Jews, I don't think that's actually an exaggeration. I really, really believe that if we look at what happened in the 30s, is actually happening now, but with different people, but with the discourse are exactly the same, the type of messaging are exactly the same, and the pogroms in the UK are exactly the same, and it's coming here, and it's and so what we're doing, what we're allowing things to happen in Palestine, in Congo, in other places, is going to be brought back home. It is going to be brought back home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that goes again in that entanglement conversation that we have having the entire time. None of this is disconnected. So the idea that these spaces of the global north can somehow be protected from the crimes and the violence they are committing is also extremely naive and shows again that massive blind spot, you know, that is created. I would like to actually make a segue, but it already some points have been mentioned to the work that We Smell Gas has done, because again, to me, it connects to definitions and how we present things and how, this law, for example, in Germany is presenting itself as defending Jewish lives in Germany. But also, for example, We Smell Gas has done work on hydrogen. And this idea of a green energy that is coming, and again, the story is much more complicated. So, please.
Yeah, no, this is a really fruitful and quite horrific link, actually, because what Salsan was just saying about the Namibian genocide. currently, there's this plan. It's like a partnership between a UK and German firm, like double corporate partnership called Hyphen, and it's this kind of mega scale green hydrogen project that's being proposed to be built in Western Namibia, including on Shark Island. Actually, there'll be this hydrogen plant in the desert, and then they're proposing to build this kind of port extension through a place called Shark Island, which is the biggest burial site for the indigenous Nama tribe, who were one of the groups that were murdered in the genocide that took place. I think it was 1904 to 1908, and that was 100,000 people, indigenous people, were murdered in that genocide. And now those indigenous people who have been fighting for over 100 years now to have reparations from Germany, both in terms of I mean, financial reparations, but also just acknowledgement that the genocide happened at all, are being completely sidelined to make way for this kind of mega so-called green energy project that won't serve Namibian interests at all. It's all being proposed to be shipped to the EU. And the irony is this is also part of a kind of an EU development scheme where they're kind of funding so-called developing economies to, produce big infrastructure projects because it will be good for their, you know, economic growth and that kind of thing. But the project isn't wanted by the indigenous people that are living in that area. It might be wanted by a few kind of corporate elites, like sitting in the Namibian government, back to that thing of kind of vested interests again. But again, we need to ask the question, why would people in that context want such a project? Well, there's also the issue of colonial debts. Mm-hmm. And how long those have been kind of like countries had to pay the European powers to, you know, to actually like let them win the anti-colonial wars, so to speak. So there's these debts that have been piling up for years and years and then, you know, being added to via these kind of development schemes. So, yeah, that's just one example, but it's happening in places in Congo as well, in Chile, in Oman. In Oman, the government have earmarked in terms of land mass of the entire country, 1/6 of the entire country has been earmarked for green hydrogen exports, which will be again destined for largely like European and American consumption and probably some of the wealthy Gulf states as well. But yeah, we're seeing these kind of like really crazy dynamics play out, and really no one's talking about it in a way as well. Like if you go into kind of climate spaces, everyone's really still talking about oil and to some extent gas, but no one's talking about green energy. And this is where we're actually going to see some of these dynamics being reproduced at a really horrific scale. So yeah, I would really encourage anyone who is motivated by anti-colonial organizing an internationalist solidarity to look into green hydrogen and what the EU is proposing, because it's really, really horrific and we really all need to get behind it and organize.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm going to actually, with that message, slide into my final question to all three of you, because then I would also like to open the stage for questions from you in the audience who've been listening so patiently. My final question goes exactly in that direction that you already just pointed out, which is, well, what to do? How to now? What would be, you know, seeing all these entanglements and all these continuities in general terms, what forms of anti-colonial resistance do you practice in We Smell Glass, Global South United, and Les Folards Violets? And maybe even what is the most important anti-colonial work that activists could do that you could, you know, pass on again as pay attention to this group or something like that? So to the practical parts of knowing all this, becoming aware of all this, what are practical steps that you take inside your groups, but also do you think, okay, you know what, this is something we all need to think about. And maybe Sasan, I would invite you to begin now.
There's a few things that can be done. Is really to become advocate for anything that is for anything that is wrong. We need to try and repair it in a way, and also protect the people that are less fortunate. One of the things as well that in terms of our actions as people living in Switzerland is also to refuse to take part in something that people want us to take part in. One of the things that we feel is extremely important anyway is to bring awareness to people on the violence it is to make referendums and initiatives targeting a group of the population. I feel that in Switzerland, and I think it's, we can actually count it, we can count the number of Islamophobic acts, and we can also count the number of escalation in racist violence against a Muslim woman or perceived Muslim woman. whenever there's political debate in the media, but also in the political sphere, that actually touches those type of subjects. One of the main campaigns that we've done with Les Foulards Violets was a campaign when there was like the anti-Burqa law that I think it was 2019, if I remember correctly, I'm not sure, 20, maybe 2019, 2020, I'm not too sure, mm-hmm. something like that. And basically, when you, if we look at it now, in the, without being part of that discourse, we just zoom out. And what we're asking the Swiss population to do is to actually cast their approval or non-approval of a segment of the population. When you look at it that way, it is extremely violent because it was never about the coverage of the face, it was about the Muslim woman and the Muslim communities. And basically what we're doing by using these institutional legal systems is to normalize Islamophobic discourse and racist discourse. And also what we're doing is try to jump on the Muslim women that actually want to have a normal life in order to violate and to ostracize Muslim men. Mm-hmm. And this is unfortunately what we've been seeing a lot, especially when we do like conversations with victims of Islamophobic acts, is most of the time they're like, if you're really like us, you would tell on your brother, you would tell on your father, you would tell on your husband, because I know that you're wearing the headscarf because someone in your close environment is actually forcing you to do it. Mm-hmm. There are also this kind of discourse where they're like, but we're trying to free you, so let me free you, you know. And the thing is that this puts the Muslim woman and or perceived Muslim woman in a situation that is extremely delicate, because in a way they're actually betting their livelihood and their security by either they become very much strongly aware of their own personas and they're aware of anything and all of the dangers that they're living, or they join the other side, the light, the good side, the Western side, and they tell on their community in the hope that they will be accepted and they will be able to have a livelihood. And this is very, it's very dangerous, and I feel that most of the time it's not really talked about a lot, because it's always kind of, it is so sensationalized. Everything becomes like a drama, but when you look at it, you're talking about women going to bring their kids to school. You're talking about women being able to pay their bills. You're talking about women that actually just want to enjoy a day in nature. You're really talking about very simple things that most of us can enjoy, but that are taking away from this segment of society with the approval of the entire country. And so I think in terms of actions that we can do as fellow resistant against this terrible system is to refuse to engage and to actually ask as many people as possible to refuse to engage when it comes to conversations, pointing fingers, segmentation of the society, because we really need to see people as people and not people as political projects.
Thank you.
Yeah, this question made me think of an article I read, I think in like March, by the Palestinian poet Mohammed Al-Kaad. I don't know if anyone's familiar with his work, but he writes incredible poetry and is also a really brilliant political writer as well. And he wrote this really great article that I really recommend everyone looks up, which was, I think the title was something like, "Are We Really All Palestinians?" And he was basically saying that, I remember really strongly this, his kind of concluding line, where he was basically like, we're not all Palestinians until we embody the Palestinian spirit of resistance. And he used this kind of phrase, which was embody the metaphor and manifest materially. And I thought that was really inspiring and really useful for us, you know, working in anti-colonial solidarity. And I feel that's a really, really strong statement. When we think of this idea of manifesting materially, that's of course, it's about producing you know, anti-colonial discourse and learning from people that we're organizing with, our friends, our comrades, people that are different from us, people that we don't know. But it's also about going a step further. It's about following the money, where are the kind of imperial tendrils like going into our world, and like where are they committing deep violence and who are the perpetrators? And we can find that out by getting a bit nerdy, doing a bit of, you know, probably quite dry corporate research or policy analysis, or asking, you know, people that we know in our movements that have those skills, finding out who are the complicit companies, who are the complicit politicians, the complicit lobbyists. And I think if we have the privilege to do so, and we all have different positionalities here, and not all of us do have that privilege, but if we do have the privilege to do so, we should be taking militant direct action against the perpetrators of settler colonialism and genocide. I think that's just kind of one like aspect of it. I think that's just in you know, with respect to the ongoing genocide in Gaza that I'm thinking about, but I think it applies in other ways too. Like, I don't know, I'm from the UK, and we just got a slightly more centre, we're not going to call them left wing, but like a slightly more centrist government. And suddenly all of the migrant justice groups kind of stopped thinking about deportations. And then the last month, everyone has kind of woken up and been like, no, people are still being deported against their will out of this country. It's just the government has a different kind of, like less of a shiny PR. They're bragging about it less. Mm-hmm. But we need to kind of still be looking and discerning and seeing how can we put our bodies on the line for other people in solidarity with them. And when we talk about solidarity, I think that's got to be something that is like non-sectarian. Like, how are we listening to people that, you know, are having struggles that are different from our own, and how are we hearing them and saying, that is not a world that I want to live in, so I'm going to listen to them, I'm going to learn, and we're going to work together, hopefully, to do something about it. And I think if we all kind of, well, who knows, but hopefully if we all embody that spirit, and we do so in a way that is, you know, looking outside of our own countries, but in an internationalist way, we can kind of slowly build the movement of movements that we need to, build a better world. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Tarek.
So I guess for Global South United, contextually, we have to address white people quite often, in terms of whether it's awareness campaigns or otherwise, because whether we like it or not, white people remain the largest mass in a country like Germany. White people remain the most powerful, the most privileged, the most people who, you know, have the luxury of actually using the privilege to do something. And I guess from there, I would like to address white people. So I think what I would like to say is that I imagine many of you consider yourselves like, you know, very conscious about the environment, very conscious about colonialism, and you do what you're trying to do to make the world a better place, et cetera, et cetera. But like, if I have to spell it out for you, in most cases, what you're doing is not enough. To save the environment from climate change, it's not enough to get a bamboo toothbrush and cut your shower down to 5 minutes, for example. We all know that it's not going to get us where we need to get to survive. And we also know that the same performative environmental politics is what brought us leadership like the Green Party in Germany, that is very actively supporting and contributing to the genocide in Palestine. And I guess also I have to spell this out too. It it's not enough to donate. It's not enough to sign petitions. You have to be a bit more vocal. You have